I'm glad to see you all this morning, and I look forward to being able to share with you some more from Revelation. Today we're going to be talking about chapter 14, Revelation 14, and also tomorrow is 15. I'm going to take a little time tomorrow to do something a little different. I'm not going to answer the questions only because there was one question that came in. I might be able to cover that one tonight, or today rather, this morning, or just cover it quickly tomorrow. But tomorrow I'm going to cover a different subject, and the reason being is I really do believe that it's a subject that should be covered. I won't tell you what it is, but it has to do with something right now in the House of Representatives. So if you're interested, you could come over and meet with us tomorrow at 9 a.m. I'm trying to edit these messages as quickly as possible. It's not easy with all of what's going on, but the messages will get out. I might put that one tomorrow out quicker than the other ones, sooner rather. So you'll see what happens. Today I'm wearing black, and I'm wearing black on purpose. It is because of the days in which we live. Just yesterday, I'll tell you about what happened, some of the things last night, because we're at the end of time here. And for a while I was saying, you know, this first wave of COVID is not about the disease, it's about control. I would say, just believing that people can think, I would say that the most of the people that have any clue have been able to see that. I felt like the first wave was going to be a bad one, and then there was going to be a time of peace and safety, if you will. Peace and safety according to the Bible. But I'm under the impression that that might not occur. We might have as they've talked about before, a second wave, and the second wave might be even more of a control grab. So we'll talk just very briefly about what's happening in regard to that. But that's why I'm wearing black today, is because I believe that it's a day of mourning, sighing and crying after the sins which are done in the land of Israel, and also, of course, in the land of Egypt and Babylon. But let's pray, and we'll get started, okay? So bow with me if you will. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for giving us this time. I do pray that you would bless us, that we can understand what it is that you're saying to us today. Guide us, please, that we can be instructed and directed according to your word. I pray that you would bless us on this, your holy day, the Sabbath, and help us to continue to honor you as we honor it, and help us to keep it holy. You have not asked us to make it holy. You've asked us to keep it holy because you have made it holy. There's no other day that's been made holy, so we ask that you'd help us to just enforce the requests that you have made and bless us in our endeavors to do so. That is, it's not us that's doing this. It is the Spirit of your Son in our hearts. And because we are adopted, you are crying, Abba, Father. And we thank you for this, asking that you would bless as we speak together. May it not be me that is speaking, but rather the words of your Son as we listen to your words. Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Revelation 14, verse 5. This is the first question. What does it mean that the 144,000 are first fruits? Okay, that's a good question. Now, to be sure, I just want to be fair. I don't understand all the answers to this question. The first fruits, because I'm not raised up in that culture, and I didn't this week have enough time to actually look into the details of it. I've tried. I've spent hours looking into this stuff, but I didn't have enough time to feel like I've got a full wrap around this idea. But so if I say something that could use a little help, I'm going to stop and ask if you have any ideas or comments, then please share. So what we have here is seven yearly feasts are in chronological order. Okay, you can see that in the book of Revelation. There's the Passover, there's unleavened bread, and there's the first fruits or wave sheaf in chapter one. And chapter one, as I said before, is the chapter which has more references than any other chapter in the book of Revelation about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, in the next chronological order in the book of Revelation itself, you have Pentecost pictured in Revelation chapter 5. It's actually 4 and 5, but 5 is the one where you see the Lamb which has seven eyes and seven horns, which are the seven spirits of God sent forth into all the earth. This God the Father has sent forth the Spirit of His Son, and of course angels are also sent forth, which are flames of fire, according to Acts chapter 2 and Psalm 104. There's a lot of information I just gave right there. But there now, trumpets comes after Pentecost, and that's in chapter 8. The Day of Atonement also comes in chapter 11 and verse 15, I believe it is, or 19, where you see the temple opened and you're able to see the Ark of the Testament in there. And then finally, Tabernacles comes in chapter 1. Now, Tabernacles is the last feast out of the seven that are mentioned there in the book of Revelation. It's also the seventh of the yearly feasts in the Old Testament. Tabernacles is the last one of the year, and it's also in the book of Revelation. So now, why I'm saying all these things is because the Feast of Harvest, the first fruits, according to Exodus 23:16, the Feast of Harvest, or first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the Feast of Ingathering, which, by the way, is the Feast of Tabernacles, which is in the end of the year when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. So the Feast of Ingathering, that should tell you something there, ingathering, it's in the end of the year. So the end of the year is when God basically started the festivals over again, the new year, right? So, you know, it was after that. That wasn't the end of the year itself, but that was toward the end of the year. In Exodus 34, 22 through 24, thou shalt observe the Feast of Weeks, of the first fruits of wheat harvest, and the first and the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end. So three times in the year shall all your men, children, appear before the Lord, the God of Israel. For I will cast out the nations before thee and enlarge thy borders. Neither shall any man desire thy land, when thou shalt go up to appear before the Lord thy God thrice in the year. So three times it says in the year. Now the Feast of Ingathering is at the end of the year. And then it's three times you're supposed to go. What are these three times? Deuteronomy 16:16 actually says, three times in a year shall all the males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose. In the Feast of Unleavened Bread, as it says in bold, in the Feast of Weeks, and in the Feast of Tabernacles. We know that according to the Bible, Tabernacles comes at the end of the year. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty. Now, let's see, I'm going to read that a little bit later. But here's the point in what I was saying in regard to the yearly festivals and also in regard to the book of Revelation, how the festivals are in chronological order. Okay, so the book of Revelation itself is in a sense, now listen to what I'm saying, in a sense it is chronological. What do I mean? Well, I've said it before many times, but in this case I'll say it again. You have in chapter 1 there's a picture of Christ followed by seven churches. In chapter 4 and 5 there's a picture of the Father and Christ and then seven seals. In chapter 8 there's a picture of Christ and seven trumpets, which takes you to the end of chapter 11, which is the first half of the book of Revelation. Every one of the churches, seals, and trumpets follows from the time of Christ on the earth all the way to the second coming of Christ on the earth. So you have three histories of the world from the time of Christ up until the second coming of Christ in the churches, the seals, and the trumpets. Okay, so those in and of themselves are three chronological orders that you can lay kind of on top of each other so that you have a ecclesiastical view, a civil view, and a war history view. Okay, so you have the churches, the states, and the wars, okay? So the churches, the feasts, and the trumpets. That's just real general if you put them into that way. You could actually call it something else, the churches and whatever you want to call the seals, whatever you want to call the trumpets. But I like to call them the churches, the states, and the civil unrest and the wars. So then when you go into chapter 12 through 16, you have another of the same history. Because chapter 12, you see a woman, she's pregnant, right? That woman was the church that had Christ ready to be delivered. Mary was represented because she was the virgin there that gave birth. But what happened was there's this dragon that's trying to kill that baby that was brought forth. What happened, of course, in history? The Roman civil nation tried to attack Christ as he had just been born from the Virgin Mary. And so, of course, the woman is not reflecting Virgin Mary specific. It's actually the church that's being referred to, the Israelite church bringing forth man-child and the man-child being attacked by Rome or Satan using Rome. And so that's probably a more specific and better way to say it. Anyways, that history starts with Christ on the earth in chapter 12, and you go through chapter 12. The end of chapter 12, you talk about water coming out of the mouth of the dragon and the earth helping the woman by, you know, sucking up the water. And then in chapter 13, you have the beast coming up out of the water and then the earth helping the woman because of the water. And so that's 13 is kind of like an enlargement of the end of chapter 12. And then 14 is at the very end of time where you have the three angels' messages going to the end of the world. Chapter 14 describes Christ coming. And then there's the sanctuary in heaven that's empty in chapter 15. And the 16 is dealing with the plagues. So you have chapter 12 through 16 going over the history of the world. So now, so far, what has happened? The church is the history. The seals, the history. The trumpets, the history. From 12 to 16, the history. From the time of Christ up into the second coming of Christ. Now, chapter 17 through 22 actually goes through another chronological scenario. You have at the very end of time, after the healing of the wound, you have this woman that is riding a beast, okay? The wound has been healed. All the world is wandering after the beast, as it says there at the end of chapter 17, and there's going to be war and persecution, and there's, you know, they're going to attack the lamb. The lamb is going to overcome them. They that are with him are called chosen and faithful. You have the fall of Babylon in chapter 18. You have the coming of Christ in 19. You have the 1,000 years of emptiness here and the saints in heaven in chapter 20. You have the holy city coming down in 21, and then everybody able to spend time with God throughout the ceaseless ages of eternity in 22. So the book of Revelation, in a sense, goes historically, chronologically through time. First it's the churches, then it's the seals, then it's the trumpets, then it's 12 through 16, and then from 17 through 22 you have the same, not really the same thing, but it's kind of the end time that's going chronological. So now, saying all that about the book of Revelation, let's understand where the feasts fit in. The feasts go in kind of a chronological order as well. They are chronological, but they do kind of a time frame as well, okay? So the tabernacles is something that hasn't even happened yet. Tabernacles will start when Christ comes to take his people up to heaven, okay? That's Tabernacles is at the very end of Revelation. It's chapter 21. It's the last of the yearly festivals. It's at the end of the year. And each Jewish year illustrated the entire salvation plan of Christ, well, God through Christ, that he would do from the time that he came until the second coming. So every year the Jews would have that visual, experiential illustration that would be given them year after year after year after year after year. And pretty soon it just became like ritualistic. It didn't mean anything. But when you take that understanding of every year that they went through those festivals and you put it over the book of Revelation, and you realize Revelation is filling those things out, and the tabernacles is at the very end of time, and we still haven't even fulfilled tabernacles. Well, I say we, but really Christ hasn't fulfilled them. You need to understand a little bit about this idea in regard to the first fruits. Now, there was a harvest during the time of the Passover, during the time of Pentecost, that era, that time frame. There was first fruits, and of course the wave sheaf, the third of the spring festivals, was when they would harvest and they would wave the brand new harvest before the Lord. And so there's also some first fruits that would be offered over there toward the end of the year, because of another harvest, different type of harvest. So now let's read from the Bible and see that kind of harvest as well. So in Deuteronomy 31, 10 through 13, I may actually have skipped that in my mind, but I'll just read this and we'll go with the Bible instead of my thoughts here for a minute. Moses commanded them, which is the children of Israel, saying, at the end of every 7 years, okay, this is the year of release, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, so now there's a few things that are put together here. The end of every 7 years, seven is a very important number to God. In fact, we see that. There's seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven thunders, seven horns, seven eyes, seven candlesticks. You go through, there's sevens all through the Bible. In fact, there is going to be 7,000 years before the Lord finally wraps up this whole earth project. I'm going to call it the earth project for a minute, because the earth was created so it could be populated, and that it would be kind of a can I say playground? I hate to use that word because it's not play, but almost a theater. I can use that word because the Bible uses the word theater. It would be a theater for the outworkings of the kingdom of Satan compared to the kingdom of God. What is it like? What would it be like in the universe if Satan ruled and if he had like almost whole, like all play? He doesn't, of course, because only what God allows does he. Is he allowed to do? He can't just run rampant and destroy everything. Not until God finally allows the angels to let loose of those four winds. But right now, at this time, God, Satan does not have full reign. But what would the kingdom look like? What would the universe look like? And so this world is that picture. That's the universe, or the rather the theater that the universe is looking at. And so when Christ came and lived a perfect life without ever choosing to surrender to the spirit of Satan while he lived 33 years on this earth, that's when the power of the enemy was broken. And so this whole picture of the history of the world in the 7,000 years is going to be what it's like when Christ has given his spirit, Satan has given his spirit. The angels are working for Christ, the angels are working for Satan, and you, by your choice, are either working for Christ or working for Satan. And so this world will only have 7,000 years. So you have all these sevens going on. So now, with this idea of the tabernacles coming into mind, at the end of every 7 years, illustrating, of course, the history of the entire earth project, in the solemnity of the year of release, which is, you know, at the end of every 7 years, in that final feast, which is the seventh of the seven each year, the Feast of Tabernacles, when so like the seven and seven and seven, okay, you got it. So when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. So the law of God is going to be read in the seventh year. Of the seventh year, every 7 years. So the seventh seven, if you will, on the seventh tabernacle, they're going to be reading the law of God before Israel. Gather the people together, men and women and children, a stranger that is within thy gates. Sounds like the Sabbath commandment to me, that they may hear and that they may learn and fear the Lord thy God and observe to do all the words of this law. And that their children, which have not known anything, may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land wherewith you go over Jordan to possess it. And so, this whole 7 year project that God, well, 7,000 year project that God has put this world into. By the way, if you do the chronological history of the world and how everybody was living this long and then died, and he had a son at this age and he lived that long, and you put all those pieces together, which I had a church member back when I was pastoring in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that did that. And it brought you to the time where, you know, like not too far in the future, that would be, you know, the full, or not too far from the time in which we live, I'll say it that way. It's, I don't know if it's the future or not. I can't recall exactly what she came up with, but 6,000 years is not too far away. And so when the earth rests for 1,000 years, well, add 1,000 to 6,000, you've got 7,000 years. And that's when God makes the whole world new again. So at the end of this 7,000 year project, right before the last seven, right before the Sabbath rest of the world, then you're going to have the, on the seventh year, the seventh month, or not the seventh month, rather, the seventh festival. There's going to be this special project that you do. It's going to be the reading of the law. And so it's all illustrating right at the end of time in the Feast of Tabernacles, you're going to have the reading of the law. Now, Christ was the first fruits. We know that according to the Bible in Corinthians. And at the end of time, we're going to have those that are an image to the Son. So this idea of the dragon of chapter 12, the beast of chapter 13, and the second beast of chapter 13 representing a false Father, Son, and Spirit. You have the dragon with the personation of the Father, the first beast of Revelation 13 with the personation of the Son, and the second beast of Revelation 13 personating the Spirit. What you have in that scenario is the dragon giving power to the beast, which gives power to the image. Okay? So now, in the same sense, we have the Father in heaven giving power to his Son, and the power giving, or the Son giving power to his image. And his image is us. We're the image of Christ on the earth, okay, in a practical sense. And so what we have here is the dragon giving power, I'm sorry, the beast giving power to his image at the end of time. You can't worship the beast and his image. That's what the third angel's all about. So that we, like the Father keeping the commandments of God through the faith of his Son, we will be making an image to the Son, which is the same way that, you know, the world is trying to make an image to the beast. And so you have this whole scenario. Christ was the first fruits while he was alive on the earth, but we at the end of time are going to be first fruits reflecting the image of the Son at the end of time. So we too will be first fruits. We're going to be that harvest that illustrates the rest of the ingathering, the rest of the harvest, if you will. And so Christ, when he was resurrected, represented the rest of the harvest. At the end of time, when we are standing true, we're going to represent the rest of the harvest. Those in the special resurrection will represent the rest of the harvest. Those that were resurrected with Christ when he came up out of, well, when he died and they were resurrected and they ascended with Christ when he led captivity captive, they were representing the rest of the harvest. So there's lots of first fruits. There's a lot of representations. It's not that we are the first fruits. We're a portion of that first fruits that represent a bigger picture. In the seventh month came the Feast of Tabernacles. Oh, by the way, it's the seventh month. I mean, like everything just fits in. There's sevens all over the place. It was tabernacles or ingathering. That's what Patriarchs and Prophets says. This feast acknowledged God's bounty in the products of the orchard. God's bounty. All right, I like that. The olive and the vineyard. Okay, so the grapes and the olives. It was the crowning festal gathering of the year. It was the greatest one, crowning. It was the final one. The land had yielded its increase. The harvests had been gathered into the granaries. The fruits, the oil, the wine had been stored, and the first fruits had been reserved. And now the people came with their tributes of thanksgiving to God, who had thus richly blessed them. This feast was to be preeminently an occasion of rejoicing. It occurred just after the Day of Atonement. Okay, so now the first fruits of the Day of Atonement will start when we go up into heaven. But it won't really be until the establishment of God's kingdom here on the earth. You can read that in Revelation 21. When the assurance had been given that their iniquity should be remembered no more. At peace with God, they now came before him to acknowledge his goodness and to praise him for his mercy. The labors of the harvest being ended and the toils of the new year not yet begun, the people were free from care, free from the influence of the enemy at the end of time. And they could give themselves up to the sacred, joyous influence of the heavenly hour at the end of time. Though only the fathers and sons were commanded to appear at the feasts, yet as far as possible, all the household were to attend them. And to their hospitality, the servants, the Levites, the stranger, and the poor were made welcome. Like the Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles was commemorative. In memory of their pilgrim life in the wilderness, the people were now to leave their houses and dwell in booths, or arbors, which were temporary, formed from the green branches of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and the boughs of thick trees and willows of the brook. Leviticus 23, 40, 42, and 43. The first day was a holy occasion, and to the 7 days of the feast, an eighth day was added, which was observed in like manner. By the way, the first day was a holy convocation, and they're like, the eighth day, wait a minute, wouldn't that make it like a Sunday? No, think about it. This day was number one, and then I'll just do it with you here. You have the first day, right? Then you have day one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. That's the eighth day, 7 days later. So you're still dealing with sevens here, with this eighth one. And so it says, which it was observed in like manner, so kind of like a Sabbath, a holy convocation. Okay, that's what that is. At these yearly assemblies, the hearts of old and young would be encouraged in the service of God, while the association of the people from the different quarters of the land would strengthen the ties that bound them to God and to one another. Well would it be for the people of God at the present time to have a Feast of Tabernacles, a joyous commemoration. Whoops. Now, well would it be? It doesn't say it is commanded that it be. It's very important to understand that language, because well would it be? Sure, there are benefits there, but it's not commanded that it's law that people have a Feast of Tabernacles. So please don't take this out of context, but it is a joyous commemoration of the blessings of God to them. As the children of Israel celebrated the deliverance that God had wrought for their fathers and his miraculous preservation of them in their journeys from Egypt, so should we gratefully call to mind the various ways he has devised for bringing us out from the world and from the darkness of error in the precious light of his grace and truth. With those who lived at a distance from the tabernacle, more than a month of every year must be occupied in attendance upon the annual feasts. It's like they were given a whole month off every, you know, for travel, and it wasn't like, you know, you could just hang out with your feet up on a couch or anything. But this example of devotion to God should emphasize the importance of religious worship and the necessity of subordinating our selfish, worldly interests to those that are spiritual and eternal. Amen. We sustain a loss when we neglect the privilege of associating together to strengthen and encourage one another in the service of God. And you know, Satan knows that. That's why today there is 6 feet apart. You know, you got to distance yourselves. You've got to be staying at home. You can't be going out and, you know, associating more than we should be, because Satan knows that we sustain a loss when we can't or we neglect the privilege of associating together to strengthen and encourage one another in the service of God. Now, I want to show you something here. This is very interesting, because in California, the California Department of Health, you can see that right there, it's OSHA. OSHA, of course, is the something that works with industrial relations. You know, like if you go and work on a job site, then OSHA has already been there, or is going to come probably if it's big time, to make sure that you have done everything appropriately. Everybody's wearing hard hats. Everybody's wearing safety glasses. You've got the orange vests on. There are delineators here and there. There's, you know, power cords that are covered correctly. They're the ones that make sure everything's right. And so it's not only the public health, but also OSHA who's come out and said COVID-19 industry guidance. Places of worship and providers of religious services and cultural ceremonies. California, all your actions save lives. This was May 25, 2020. So this is California government run direction for, you know, staying away from each other. Here, for example, physical distancing to the maximum extent possible. Use face coverings, frequent hand washing, train your employees and volunteers to help prevent COVID. The purpose, of course, is to have places of worship and providers of religious services and cultural ceremonies to be, kept in order. And this does not obligate places of worship to resume in-person activity. Okay. Let's see. I'll just read a couple of things here. There must be a limit attendance of 25% of a building or a maximum of 100 attendees, whichever is lower. Okay. And so that means, like, if you have a big building where you're trying to worship God with his people and the building is packed, you have just cut your congregation in one quarter or to 100 people if it's whichever is less. So you basically, they have tried to completely wipe out the big churches, which is, you know, following more counsel than they realize, because we're not supposed to have big churches. But this is a huge governmental control over churches, over worship services, but we're not done yet. I want to keep looking at this article. Workspace specific plans established. It's written topics for employees and volunteer training. It goes on and talks about the proper use of face coverings. And then it goes on individual control measures and screening. You can see that cleaning and dispensing protocols. It talks about, there's a section down here, physical distance guidelines. Okay, so you can just see you should continue services through alternative methods, recorded streaming, telephone, drive-ins, etc., wherever it's possible. Why? Well, because they listen to our phone calls and they're watching us right now on you know, Zoom. The internet, they can control that. They can take it off or, you know, just suspend it if they want to. You can hold in-person meetings if you want to outside whenever is possible. You need to have physical distancing at least 6 feet apart. And you certainly have to have dedicated staff to maintain this distancing of people. Shorten your services. You can't have the regular services like you've had before, of course, because you need to include limiting speeches, and there are some places where it says you can't even sing publicly because you're, you know, breathing too hard on people. You come close places of worship for visitation outside of the scheduled services. Consider implementing a reservation system to limit the number of congregants or attendees visiting that facility. And you want to have small group meetings. You don't want to have big ones. Additional meeting times, so per day or per week, so that you can have smaller groups. You don't want to have large gatherings. Children should remain in the care of those of their household and not interact with other children. You can encourage congregants and visitors to physically distance themselves. Consider limiting touch, you know, no hugs, certainly not. Dedicated staff to direct guide guests to meeting rooms upon entry. And of course, props for doors to hold them open so that you can get fresh air. Close or restrict common areas such as break rooms, kitchenettes, foyers. Turn off public drinking water fountains like they've done in most like public places, Target, Walmart, those various places. Remove from the service if you find any, remove from the service or find low community touch alternatives for communal religious water containers. So like, you know, if you need water, which you should have, you just use something that you can throw away. Washing the hands frequently. Reconfigure the podiums and speaker areas so they're not too close to people, at least, definitely. Establish directional hallways so you can walk one direction on one side of the hallway and the other direction on the other side of the hallway. Limit the number of individuals riding in an elevator. Utilize practices when feasible and necessary to limit the number of staff and congregants visiting in an office or a meeting space. Offer workers and volunteers modified duty options, you know, like spraying down things that people touch, kind of like they do at Target right now. Stagger breaks so that, you know, not everybody's breaking together in the same room. Discontinue non-essential travel. Choose self-service item selection such as pamphlet display and bookshelves. And another place I read, they were told that they can't really pass around a offering plate because too many people are touching it. Limit the number of people that use the restroom at a time. And you can't do handshakes or hugs, or at least you could discourage it. Reconfigure parking lots so people don't have to be so close together. And to continue to support non-in-person attendance services. And here are more considerations for places of worship, like that wasn't enough already. For funerals, right? You can't be too close in funerals. So, I mean, this whole idea of not coming together and being a blessing to one another is actually contrary to the festivals that God had set up in the Old Testament, which is reflecting of what Christ is now doing in the heavens for us. Like right now, for example, we're in the Day of Atonement. So why would it be a law to keep the Festival of Tabernacles if we are currently in the midst of fulfilling the Day of Atonement? So that's a good question that I would have. But let's go back to this quote real quick, and I just want to read the rest of it. So We sustain a loss when we neglect the privilege of associating together to strengthen and encourage one another in the service of God. The truths of His Word lose their vividness and importance in our minds if we don't fellowship with one another. Our hearts cease to be enlightened and aroused by the sanctifying influence, and we do what? We decline spiritually. So no wonder the enemy is trying to get us away from associating together to strengthen one another. In our intercourse as Christians, we lose much by the lack of sympathy with one another. He who shuts himself up to himself in your own home because you have to is not fulfilling the position that God designed he should. We are all children of one Father, dependent upon one another for happiness. The claims of God and of humanity are upon us. It is the proper cultivation of the social element of our nature that brings us into sympathy with our brethren and affords us happiness in the efforts to bless others. So the Feast of Tabernacles was not only commemorative, but typical. Still reading the quote here. It not only pointed back to the wilderness sojourn, but as the feast of, what's that word? Harvest, it celebrated the ingathering of fruits of the earth and pointed forward to the great day of the final ingathering, when the Lord of the harvest shall send forth his reapers to gather the tares together in bundles. His reapers are the angels. You can read that in the book of Matthew. For the fire, it says, he will send forth his reapers to gather the tares together in bundles for the fire and gather the wheat into his garner. That's Matthew 13, for example. At that time, the wicked will all be destroyed. They will become as though they had not been, according to Obadiah 16. And every voice in the whole universe will unite in joyful praise to God. Says the Revelator, which is John, every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and such as is in the sea and all that are in them heard I saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be unto him that sits upon the throne and unto the Lamb forever. In Revelation 5, verse 13. The people of Israel praised God at the Feast of Tabernacles as they called to mind his mercy in the deliverance from the bondage of Egypt and his tender care for them during their pilgrim life in the wilderness. They rejoiced also in the consciousness of pardon and acceptance through the service of the Day of Atonement just ended. But when the ransomed of the Lord shall have been safely gathered into the heavenly Canaan, forever delivered from the bondage of the curse, under which the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain until now, Romans 8:22, they will rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Christ's great work of atonement for men will then have been completed, and their sins will have been blotted out forever. So, this is the idea that God has given, in my mind anyways, to the final people at the end of time, the 144,000 being referred to as the first fruits. I don't know that I've ever read about second fruits, but the first fruits were the very first thing that was harvested, and that was offered to the Lord. It's kind of like the tithe. You know, God has asked us to return to him tithe, and what we do is we take the amount that we get, and the first thing we do is cut off that first fruits, that tithe for the Lord that he has requested. And so we are taking the first part that of the harvest, which, by the way, that's what they would tithe as well. They would tithe their harvest because that was their income. And so they would take that first fruits and they would give it unto the Lord. So second fruits, I'm not aware of. Maybe somebody else has thought of that before or has studied it. I just haven't. In Revelation 14:18, why does this angel come out from the altar instead of from the temple? Good question. Why from the altar instead of from the temple? What does it mean to have power over fire? I'm going to read that section here. In 5:8, we read of angels having incense. So, well, Revelation 14:18. Let me just go ahead and read that real quick because that will help us understand. I've got to open my app real quick. So Revelation 14:18, another angel came out from the altar. So he came out not from the temple, but from the altar, which had power over fire. He cried with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sickle, thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. Okay, so when going back to this idea of why Did he come from the altar? I'm going to answer that one first, and then fire later in this answer. And like I said, I'll ask if you guys have any further comments on this. When he had taken the book, okay, this is the lamb. When the lamb had taken the book, the four beasts, which I believe are angels, the 24 elders, which I believe are angels, fell down before the lamb. Every one of them, the beasts and the elders, every one of them having harps and golden vials full of odors. These golden vials full of odors are what? The prayers of the saints. Okay. So these beasts, which according to 1st chapter and 10th chapter of Ezekiel, seem to be the same ones directed here or described here, which are called cherubim over there in Ezekiel 10. And the 24 elders, which when we studied chapter 5, I believe it was. But they're the ones that have these vials that are full of odors, which are the prayers. So I happen to believe that angels have a great part in doing the ministry from the earth to heaven with our prayers. The reason being is Jacob's dream in Genesis chapter 28, verses 11 through 13. You can read that for yourself, as we've already gone through it here in this series. It seems that angels work closely with the altar. Why? Because of the prayers. They represent the priests that served in the earthly tabernacle. Now, so those priests, not the high priest, but the priests. Notice what it says in Leviticus 4, 3 through 7. If the priest, not the high priest, if the priest that is anointed, because they were all anointed, all the priests were, they were anointed on their right ear, their right thumb, and their right big toe. If, it says, the priest that was anointed do sin according to the sin of the people, then let him bring for his sin, which he hath sinned, a young bullock, okay, without blemish unto the Lord for a sin offering. So this young bullock represents Christ. And he shall bring the bullock unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. He will lay his hand upon the head of the bullock. Why? Because he's confessing his sins. And then he will kill the bullock, because Christ would die for him. He will kill the bullock before the Lord. And the priest that is anointed shall take of the bullock's blood and bring it to the tabernacle of the congregation. And the priest shall dip his finger into the blood and sprinkle the blood seven times before the Lord, before, not upon, but before the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood upon the horns of the altar. Now that's upon, not before, but upon the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall pour all the blood of the bullock at the bottom of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So this is the priest doing ministry. And what does he do ministry with? He does ministry with the sweet incense, okay? This is not the high priest. It says in Revelation 14, 18 through 20, another angel came from the altar, there's that word again, that's the first question that we had in regard to this, which had power over fire. There's the question. Why does he have power over fire? He cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. So this one having power over fire, what does he do? He casts the vineyard that he had, or his that he commanded to be harvested, into the winepress of the wrath of God. The winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out from the winepress, even unto the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. So this is taken actually from something online I found, and I kind of just adapted it to my own thinking. The city mentioned in this verse is likely Old Jerusalem. The judgment God executes on the wicked centers outside the city, which is Jerusalem, apparently so, because that's where Jesus bore God's wrath for our sins. And of course, that represents being outside the city when the city comes down at the end of the 1,000 years Revelation chapter 20. His cross was located at Golgotha, which was located outside the city. of Jerusalem. You can see that in John 19, 16 through 18. This passage uses the symbolism of grapes in a wine press to describe the eventual defeat of the wicked in the end times. As grapes are crushed and broken to release wine, God's enemies will be crushed in a bloody defeat. Taken in literal terms, this verse describes a cascade of blood some 5 feet tall, just under 2 meters, and 100 to 200 miles, or 290 to 320 kilometers long. I would understand this is primarily symbolic, as I think most people would. Whether entirely or partly poetic, one thing is certain. This judgment creates a gory scene. Revelation 19:13 pictures Jesus as having blood on his robe as he rides into warfare against the wicked. Although some believe this is the blood of Jesus shed on the cross, others see this as the blood of his enemies. I would imagine it's the blood of the cross, but I'm not sure. I wouldn't mind either way, I suppose. The interpretation that is in the blood of his enemies is supported by the prophetic picture given in Isaiah 63:2-4, which, if you wanted to read that real quick, we could do that. There was a bullet point there that needs to be taken out. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth out or in the wine fat? So here we're treading in the wine fat. I have trodden the wine press alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury. Their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments. Oh, okay, that's a good point. Why it would be the blood of those that are being crushed. And I will stain all my raiment, for the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. So yeah, that's a good one there. Nice verse to add to that section. So any thoughts on that, why there would be coming from the altar of incense and also having power over fire? Incense seems to be relevant to the prayers ascending and descending, with the angels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man, or the latter in Genesis 28. But also the fire represents the destruction or the judgment that God has involved the angels in as well.